downstairs.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Hey, and welcome to the special edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is your host, Señor Andrew Horowitz, and it is Cinco de Mayo week, one of those great weeks where the Mexican restaurants are packed and we're partying, drinking beers. Hang on a second, let me finish this up, get this, gonna celebrate in style here. All right, having a lot of fun here during this recent incredibly powerful market move. Just an amazing amount of positive sentiment that has turned almost on a dime. I don't know if it's going to last. It does seem like it is a short cover rally and a bear market bounce. Unfortunately, I know I've been rather negative in the sentiment of late, but I think that next week we're going to see a slightly different tone to the markets. A lot of the earnings have been out. As a matter of fact, I'm going to put a link for you. I wrote an article, pretty lengthy article for AOL Finance this week on the week to come. If you're looking for really the earnings and what's going on with what's happening in the news, I try each and every week to put together what are the most important and the most prevalent issues that are going to be shaping the markets for the week to come, of course, aside from any surprises that we may see. And I do that on AOL Finance, AOL Money. So I'll put a link there, and I have a list, a pretty lengthy list of earnings, because right now, earnings is really the driver of these markets. We've seen the economics moving, the markets very impressively when we saw Federal Reserve Chair really just spend some time thinking about what the next move is going to be, it seems, lowering the rate by about a quarter point, and then on Friday, surprising us with another interesting pre-market move to essentially allow for additional bailout measures for not only the automobile and credit card industry, but it seems that he added another $50 billion to an area that, scratch your head here, is much more, let's say, lower profile than the discount window is, because the discount window right now is being attacked voraciously by anybody that can get their hands on money. The rates are low. Banks and firms of in the brokerage industry are just really just amazing, just going out and tearing it up, getting in a ton of money from the discount window. And now the secondary place where they can get money from is now being funded a little bit more dramatically. What's interesting about that is that we're finding it seems that they can go and have not only a lower profile, but there is no requirement for disclosure. So therefore, if there is a bank or a brokerage or somebody that's in trouble and needs to go get money, and it's approved, they're on the, you know, can get so from here, what's going to happen is they don't have to actually show it, which is kind of disturbing in a world where we're trying to get transparency in the open. Nonetheless, we are going to talk about a few things. I'll give you some of those actual things that I want you to look at, and then I'll give you some links there. We have some great insight from Zach Stocks in the Zach Zone today. Zach Scheidt is, of course, in the Zach Zone on the IPO and new issue market. And some people ask me, why are we doing that? Why do we have the new issues? Because you know what? Right now, with the markets the way they are, new issues are a great way to diversify your portfolio, because a lot of things that would traditionally be working are not, and vice versa. So we thought that it would be interesting to give you a quick education in the IPO market. And boy, he's been on fire. We also have a special guest with us today, Felix Salmon, who is the writer for the Condé Nast Portfolio. He is a really well-read and an interesting fellow. We're going to talk with him about, I have questions about this Microsoft Yahoo situation, which we're going to get into in a moment, and some of my thoughts there, and we'll go through that. So with that in mind, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk to you about a few things on my mind, then get right into an interview with Felix Salmon from Condé Nast Portfolio. And you are listening to the special Cinco de Mayo version of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Let me get a little sip of this here. Hang on a second. Great. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back. We get some great questions on the email and on the site, and I want to thank you for that. It's giving me some great show ideas and doing our best to keep it as lively and interesting as possible, even though sometimes I do seem to be quite gloomy. Again, so far so good, though, because obviously we've had one foot out and one foot in these markets. I hope you've noticed that. And some of the short positions that we've had, although we did cover the Capital One for some nice profit, and then we covered it on a stop part of it as well, went up a little bit higher. That was kind of a very concerning move, but we'll see what happens next week with that. And though I did receive a bunch of emails that had the same theme, and let me give you the example of one of them. Edward writes, "I'm still very skeptical about the market, having lost too much money over the last year. Can you do a show or recommend a safe place to put cash?" That's a great question, because what is safe right now, right? I mean, we have this situation where there is a concern in the banking sector, the financial sector, which of course, where you put your cash. What I would do is this. There's a lot of places that I like. We do a tremendous amount of business with Schwab, the institutional division of Schwab. If you're going to put your cash anywhere, obviously, you're not going to make a lot of interest right now in the 2, 3, maybe 4% range if you're really lucky on a CD. What I want you to do is make sure that you put under the $100,000 in any bank, because obviously utilize those FDIC rules and laws. But more importantly, spread the risk. Where can you put cash? Where can you put money markets? Right now, keep it short, keep it safe. I think that's the best thing that you could do. Obvious information, but here's the point of all this. There's some great alternatives on the tax-free side. Look for money markets that have short-term tax-free bonds, very, very short term, in the money market area. So you're going to look for a short term bond fund that's in treasury municipals, or you're going to look for money markets that are tax free. And if you do it through mutual funds, you could possibly make a better after tax rate of return than you can right now in the banks, even in the brokerage houses, if you have the money in those money markets. That brings up one more point. Actually, maybe two more points. I need you to do me a favor. I need your help. I need you to help me understand a little bit more about who you are, what you want, and just really so I can help to tell the show. And we are doing our best to bring great guests on board and topics, et cetera, that may interest you. But, you know, I get these great emails in, but I really need to know more about you. Please do me a favor. Go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Please, please, please do this. Go there. Fill out the survey that is very simple, it's going to be confidential, nothing really is revealed anyway, but tell me more about who you are. Tell me more about what you want. It'll take you 2 minutes to fill out the survey, and then what we can do is we're going to compile this together and share with you what it is that you're looking for, and you could really be an integral part of the show and to really create just an amazing opportunity to continue on this community spirit and to really bring you exactly and target exactly what you want to hear. So please do that. Go to the survey. I'll remind you a little bit later also on what to do with that. So here's the point about that I want to bring to you. Risk management. I think risk management is, you know, it's bantered around. It's talked about like, I don't know, it's just, you know, oh, we have risk management, we have downside protection, and in my portfolio, I make sure that we do either sell stops or something like that. But what is risk management? Here's what I wrote on page 103 of my book, The Disciplined Investor. Risk management is the analysis of possible loss, the professional or technique of determining, minimizing, and preventing accidental loss. For example, this could be accomplished when a business takes specific safety measures or buys liability insurance. Well, I also write, the above may be suitable for a definition for the financial professional. But what exactly is risk management, and how do individual investors deal with this? You know, how does it fit into the big scheme of things when it comes to your portfolio? Because when you look at things like a market crash and you look at, you know, recessions and depressions and whatever else may be, because we don't need risk management if things are going up to the roof, right? No, of course not. But if things are going down is where we really need to make sure we're careful. So what I did here was, I have a whole chapter that's dedicated to this, and I talk about things like market timing and does market timing work, and give you a really interesting analysis of what I call the smart money's pundit scorecard, and show you historically, how did it work? How did these market pundits fair and show you that only one out of four possible scenarios when we look at either in or out of the market, buy or sell stocks, really worked for market timing and explain how that doesn't work. But I also go into things like covered calls. For example, I have a whole definition of covered calls and a 4 or 5 page about using covered calls while you're investing to make sure that you're protecting the asset. I'll give you an exact example of what we did that in real life this week. As Apple was approaching their earnings news that was coming out, it seemed that there was a lot of opportunity to make money, right? Because we saw all the technology stocks really just popping and popping with their earnings. So what we did was we have Apple anywhere from $60 to about $114 on average or so, and picked up a few at about the $135 range or $140 range for clients. What we did was we went out and we found the best option, or you know, the call option, sold it against the stock that we owned. On not all of it, but on some of it. We picked up the $185 in the June options for about $6 to $6.50. So in other words, when the stock was about $165 or so, I think it was $167 to be exact, we sold the call, the opportunity to sell the stock at $185 and picked up $6. Essentially, $185 plus six or so is $191. Therefore, if the stock goes down, we still keep the $6 if you understand how a covered call works. And if you don't understand how a covered call works, go buy the book. It's on sale, by the way. By the way, I just saw it at Amazon. I think it's like $13.50 over at Amazon. Amazon doesn't always keep those prices, so if you want to get it, I would suggest you do so quickly. But I go through this whole idea of who should use a covered option and who should use a covered call and give you exact details of how to do it and step-by-step techniques. In addition to that, surprise announcement, here we go. A lot of people are saying, well, you have all this information. How can I implement it for myself? Well, you know, we did. I have one done so far, is a workbook, The Disciplined Investor. Each chapter, we're taking the workbook approach to the chapter. And when you know the information and you master it and you become a disciplined investor, like so many of you have written me that you have, you can go one step further. Now we have workbooks that we're creating. Pretty cool? I hope so. I think it's going to be nice because I think that when we actually implement this process and these strategies, it makes you a much stronger investor. And being a much stronger investor only makes sense because you want to make much more money, of course. So anyway, this whole idea of risk management, we won't belabor the point here, is to make sure that not only do you profit in the good times, but you don't lose in the bad times. I've talked about this 100 times, and I've talked about this whole idea of this flower garden, right? Because this flower garden is what you want your portfolio to look like. Because what happens is that if you have only one type of flower, let's say like impatience, and it looks beautiful 2 or 3 months out of the year, but then they just die and you have this pile of this rotting flowers, no, that's not how you want your portfolio. We want to have an asset allocation approach where we have many different things blooming at every different time. But at the same time, even though we have all these things blooming during every different season, and so we have something to bloom at all times, what happens with things just, we have this huge frost? Well, an evergreen, like a money market, is always green, but we want to make sure, again, that we take things inside, out of the cold. That's what risk management is all about. Risk management keeps your money where it should be, right in your pocket. That's where it should be, and it should stay there. Make sure to protect the gains, because sometimes, remember we had Tim Knight on from The Slope of Hope, talks about what is that slope? That slope is that downside when things start getting away, and all you do is hope that they do better. We get back, we're going to talk to Felix Salmon, and I think that you're going to be very pleased. He's a really smart guy, and I'm glad to have him on the show. Glad to have you on the show. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll be right back. Welcome back, and let's get right into our discussion with a great guy, Felix Salmon. And Felix Salmon arrived in the United States in 1997 from England, across the pond, as we say, where he worked at Euromoney magazine. He also wrote daily commentary on Latin American markets for his former news service called Bridge News. He freelanced for a variety of publications, helped set up the New York Bureau of a Financial website, and created the EconoMonitor blog for Rubini Global Economics. He's been blogging since 1999, and now he writes from the Market Movers column in Portfolio.com. Graduate of the University of Glasgow, and a great guy, a wonderful fellow. I met him recently and read his work quite often, and you should too. So thanks for joining us, Felix.
My pleasure.
So what are you seeing these days? I mean, obviously there's been a lot of Well, there's been a lot of things going on. There's no lack of things to write about, right?
Absolutely, especially on the credit side of things. It's weird how the stock market seems to have made up its mind that the credit problems are over, even when today's announcement from the Fed and the ECB clearly proves that they're not.
Let's get into that for a second, because that was a very, it was almost like a little blip before the earnings number, seemingly trying to, get backseat to whatever was about to happen. It was what, within 15 minutes of the earnings number this morning, right?
I don't actually pay much attention to earnings, but yeah.
Not the earnings, that's right, not the earnings number. I mean the employment number, forgive me.
Oh, the employment number. The what's it called? The payrolls?
It was the non-farm payrolls. But so what is the story with this Fed? What are they doing?
They're expanding what they've been doing for the past few months, which is using their balance sheet to inject liquidity into the market. And every time they do it, the market gets terribly excited, and then it proves to be insufficient, so they inject a bit more liquidity and a bit more liquidity and a bit more liquidity by extending various credit lines, first to commercial banks and then to investment banks, and on longer and longer terms. First it's overnight, then it's 28 days, and with weaker and weaker forms of collateral, the Bank of England, it seems to, at this point, essentially just be buying mortgage bonds. So they're really trying to keep the banks lending and keep the economy going through extending very liquid credit, treasury bonds, and just money, basically, in return for the seized up assets, which the banks can't really leverage anymore.
So is it going to work?
Well, it hasn't worked yet.
If it hasn't worked yet, why does the market keep on going up and everybody, goo goo gaga?
The market is broken. The market has seized up, and the market is absolutely not a healthy place at all. Now, the stock market, on the other hand, seems to be on a completely different planet.
Mm-hmm.
But the stock market is not the world's best indicator of what's going on in the world of credit. And credit is what matters in terms of the economy.
So but the economy, now let's bring all this together now. So the economy, though, is a the capitalistic structure underpinning the companies that the stock market is a proxy for. No?
Yes.
Okay. So if the underlying credit is broken and the economy is out of whack, doesn't that eventually affect the stock market, or is it just?
One would think, wouldn't one?
Yeah, I would think. I've been on this. Listen, I've told everybody I've been on a rampage about a few of these areas. And listen, it's been since last July. I've been very concerned, and I kind of have tiptoed in a few areas, got my foot chopped off on one or two, and did well on another. But it seems to me that there is a bit of euphoric attitude right now. That it maybe it's just a short cover. I don't know. But so let me ask you. You just wrote about Microsoft and Yahoo. You wrote about it a couple of days back. I was reading about it. What do you think is going to be the upshot there?
Well, your guess is as good as mine on that one. I don't understand why, if they were going to go hostile, if they were going to launch some big tender offer, why they wouldn't have done it by now. And this weird delay, these kind of leaks, the Wall Street Journal keeps on getting these leaks. They're going to bid 33. They could go up to 33. They probably will put their own slate of directors up. We think they're going to do this, and it's all sort of in the conditional future tense. And ultimately, it's all up to Steve Ballmer, and he hasn't quite made up his mind yet. It's weird. If you've made this aggressive takeover offer and then sit there twiddling your thumbs for months, people kind of wonder what you're thinking. And it's not clear who's advising them or whether they're having cold feet, but takeovers which drag on for a long time tend to be less likely to succeed. Although, as we saw with Rupert Murdoch buying Dow Jones, there are always exceptions.
Right. So the thing about the Microsoft Yahoo thing, which I think is fascinating, is the real reason, which I don't know if we ever will know, but the real reason why Microsoft is looking to merge buy Yahoo because there's so many roadblocks, so many problems. I mean, you know, you have a cultural issue that could be a huge problem where Microsoft is, you know, kind of like the old IBM compared to what Microsoft was in the beginning. You know, it's sort of like, you know, IBM, Apple, you know, when, you know, Yahoo is much more laid back, a different kind of company, and Microsoft is a very stiff-shirted company comparatively. And Yang has been really adamant. Was it Yang who said he wants 37 now, right?
Yang's in a tough position. I think quite clearly Yang doesn't want to sell at any price, but he has to let his board sell at some point. And it seems to be somewhere in that $35 to $37 range that they just feel that they can't say no.
Yeah, I don't know. You know what? The company was, I don't even know, 10 points lower before the offer. And it would seem that this is a great deal for Microsoft. In my opinion, this is my thesis on this, by the way. Tell me what you think. That Microsoft is not looking at for the ad buy per se. They're looking at for, they realize that they've missed the boat on the last two compressed generations. This Facebook generation that's doing everything online, you know, kind of the cloud discussion we've had. And, you know, they're looking to really kind of skip over and say, okay, we really need to get back. Desktop is great. Windows is great. But if we're really going to succeed and really continue to be, you know, conquer the world of software and technology, we need to get the next generation because we lost the last two.
I don't quite see how they're going to get the next generation by buying Yahoo. Yahoo has a huge number of users, but they're not exactly the MySpace generation, are they?
Well, MySpace and Facebook, they're not the MySpace, but not exactly, but at least they're trying to get the people that are using online as their place. I mean, the number one, clearly, people are going there. There's no, you know, there's no documents, there's no apps, there's no anything. It's all online for Yahoo.
What I would ask you in that case, isn't this destined in this case to become just a replay of when Time Warner merged with AOL and they were spinning that as this is how we managed to buy into the online generation and we saw how well that worked out.
No, that was fun. That was a beautiful thing. The only difference is at the height. Well, maybe now is the height of it. It could be, but I just think that
see that Yahoo is very AOL-ish in it. Behind the curve, mm-hmm. mass market nature.
Right.
If you want to be forward looking and get the Facebook generation and the one after that, you have to ask yourself how many 12-year-olds are using Yahoo?
Yeah, possibly. Well, I just think it's more of a panic play. Also, they feel they need to do something. I don't know if you've seen the move from, you know, the kind of the square looking Microsoft site to now a lot of kind of colors and you know, kind of curvy. I mean, that's a small, silly thing, but I think they're trying as best as they can to change their image. And whether the Yahoo deal is it or not, and I don't know, but they're trying desperately to do something.
Well, they are trying, yes, but I don't think they're succeeding. No, their big, you know, play is obviously Vista, which has been something of a disaster in terms of public perception, even if it is making them money.
Right. So, you know, skipping on over to the same kind of topic, you know, talking about content issues, what's your take on the whole world of bloggerism and New York Times and the whole Wall Street Journal kind of going? There were some really interesting articles I read recently about the Wall Street Journal kind of going much more political versus sliding away from business finance and kind of a change to the environment. What's your take?
My take on that is that it is not sliding away from business and finance. Mm-hmm. Wall Street Journal's business and finance coverage is as strong as ever. I mean, you've seen them owning this Microsoft Yahoo story.
Mm-hmm.
And that the newspaper is definitely increasing its political and general interest coverage, especially in the first section and in the front page.
Mm-hmm.
That's not coming at the expense of business and finance. It's just coming maybe at the expense of the amount of coverage that those stories get on the front page.
Yeah. Do you think, with that in mind, there's a lot of, and you may have been reading it, but there's a lot of discussion about, I've seen a lot of discussion, maybe it's just the things I read, a lot of discussion about this and a lot of picayune about, you know, the various, you know, the things that are going on and getting into the real minutiae about, you know, how much it's changed. Do you think that bloggers are becoming a little bit too picayune about just the goings on of things, and it's just like, you know, continually picking scabs and getting into places that, you know, don't really have any bigger meaning in the world, but it just makes for something to write about?
There's nothing which the media loves to write about more than itself.
Or talk about, I guess.
So, right. So it's, feel free to ignore all of the random blabberings about the relative merits of this editor versus that editor, or this business model versus that business model at the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal will continue to give you your business news if that's what you read for your business news. And you're quite right that if you're an investor, the ownership structure of the Wall Street Journal and the question of how much politics it features on its front page is not relevant in the slightest.
Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. So, airline. So, listen, you're from. You have a slight accent. I believe that's UK. And
it is
my favorite of all. And if I dare say, I don't know you very well with this, but it's, I'm sure you have the same opinion on this that I do. My favorite airline, bar none, and my favorite upper class, first class, is Virgin Air. Am I somewhere in the ballpark when you go overseas? Will you choose to fly Virgin?
I fly Virgin a lot. I wouldn't say necessarily it's my favorite, but it's. I would say it's my favorite transatlantic airline.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, we don't have over on my side. We don't have Virgin yet. But have you been in
I just flew back yesterday from L.A. on Virgin America, which is excellent.
It's great, huh? Have you been on the upper class cross Atlantic where they have the masseuse on board?
I have, and I put my name in, and I wasn't chosen.
Me too. Oh, the same thing happened to me. I was so bummed. It was like hours and hours of the flight. I'm thinking, when am I going? Oh, sorry, sir. I said, what do you mean? I've been waiting the whole time. I haven't slept. I'm waiting. That's a true story. But the warm nuts were excellent, nonetheless. So the airline business, said with quotes around the word business, was it something that we could have foreseen with the deregulation? And it almost seems, by the way, the deregulation process for over the decades or whatever, it seems to be, I don't know, weirdly like we're going backwards in a lot of these areas. Doesn't it seem that way? It seems like these companies that have gone on their own and try to go at it for one reason or the other are having a miserable time at it. And airlines right now is the one in focus.
I frankly don't see a huge amount of deregulation in the U.S. airline market. If anything, the opposite. I see a huge number of legacy carriers competing with a small number of little upstarts like Southwest and JetBlue, who either hedge their oil exposure, in which case they're doing great, or they don't, in which case they're doing badly, just like everyone else. I see that foreign airlines are barred from taking anything more than 25% stake in U.S. airlines. I don't see anything like the vibrancy that you see in the European market with loads of airlines sprouting up and flying all over the place at incredibly low prices. I see high prices, frankly. JetBlue and Southwest both started as low-price airlines, but they realized that they weren't really competing with anyone, so they just let their prices rise. And I think deregulation, if it really happened, would be a great thing in the U.S., but it hasn't happened. I think that the big legacy airlines, Uniteds and Deltas and Americans and Continentals, are in much the same boat as the big legacy car makers. They have these enormous historical pension and medical obligations, which they can't get out of, and they have these big unwieldy union contracts, which they can't get out of. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to look for vibrancy and excitement and a healthy airline industry in the U.S., I think really your only hope is to let those guys slowly decline and fail and let other younger, nimbler airlines come in their place.
Yeah, I guess I was talking about really back to the 1970s, for those of us who are around, and looking at there was obviously airline deregulation. I mean, we were regulated, and it was a fully regulated system prior to that. And it seems that, when I look at that, I guess it was back in, I don't know, look at something up here, 1978. There was this, kind of that and some of the other industries, kind of like savings and loan. Again, way back when till now. I'm not talking about recent. I'm talking about kind of historically.
There's deregulation 70s style and there's deregulation 2000s style.
Yeah.
And we've moved on from there. And what we need now is even more and even more up to date, rather than wondering whether the 70s style deregulation worked.
Yeah, no, I hear you. But it's amazing. It's almost like it's a guessing game right now with the airlines. That, you know, who's going to be the appropriate one to merge with who, or potentially at least. And so oil prices sustainable, or generally sustainable, not exactly at 110, 120. I mean, you know, are we running out of fossil fuel?
Don't get me started on the whole peak oil thing.
Sorry.
I try to duck that debate as much as I possibly
All right.
can.
Okay.
But, it's. I think they're related to, well, obviously the weakness of the dollar, but of course they're high in any currency. And global economic growth. If the U.S. really does enter a long and harsh recession, there's a lot of doomsmongers are telling us that it will, that mm-hmm. will have a deleterious effect on the rest of the world. And it really wasn't that long ago when oil was at $10 a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And it could happen. I don't know if it'll go back down to 10, but it's amazing how oil is basically a leveraged play on global growth. And when global growth is strong, it goes very well. And when global growth slows down, it can come down quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear. So what's your general let me encapsulate the discussion. Here is Felix's general outlook about, you know, the U.S. world and the world economies, you know, or let's start with the world. Let's say the world. What's the world looking like to you?
China's looking great. India's looking good. Africa's looking great. Better than ever, really, in living memory.
Mm-hmm.
Europe is surprisingly strong. The UK is maybe entering something of a downdraft. And, you know, so long as commodity prices are high, then your big commodity-rich countries like Australia, South Africa, Russia, Brazil are going to be fantastic. Brazil, I don't know if you saw, just finally got its investment-grade credit rating from S&P. For those of us who mm-hmm. lived through 2002 when Lula was running for president and the spreads on its debt were over 2,000 basis points, that's just unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that whole Latin America blow up back in those years with the Mexican devaluation, you know, the Monday morning, I think it was like a Monday morning devaluation. Good morning. You know, here's a little devaluation for you, huh? What? Yeah, your dollar's worth 50 cents.
Brazil did it. Argentina did it. Uruguay did it. They all went through it.
Yeah, can you imagine waking up, you know, your dollar, it's worth 50 cents. Don't worry about it, though. We'll fix it one day.
I kind of feel like I did that, actually. I'm flying to Europe tomorrow, and I can tell you it feels a bit like that.
Yeah. So, all right, great. So I appreciate you coming on board. And where's the best place? Where would you, if people could read your work and see what you do, where do you want them to go?
Oh, come see me in Berlin. I'm on my way over there tomorrow. It's a great place.
Oh, aside, you're in concert. But aside from that, how about on the web? The best place to click to, let's say that.
But if you don't want to come see me in person, then check me out at marketmovers.org.
Okay, great. Marketmovers.org. So we'll do that. And Felix Salmon, great stuff. I really think that you are one of the great writers out there, great bloggers, great insights into the markets. I want to thank you so much for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
Now, since then, as you know, we had a revelation. Something happened at Microsoft that they seem to have withdrawn their bid. And I believe that Felix was right that there is a lot of, you know, a lot of posturing going on, and we talked a little bit about what has to happen, what could happen, and I don't think that it's over yet. I just don't believe that we are seeing the end of this. It is quite possible that even though they withdrew and took down the bid for Yahoo, Microsoft is still posturing, and this is part of the hostile takeover. By the time you get this, it may be in the early part of the week, Yahoo's going to be down significantly because really there is nothing to hold up the price right now. There's no other suitors. So I believe that, you know, everything that was talked about here is rather, I think it's rather, you know, still going to be something that is very viable. We'll see what happens. When we get back, when we turn around right in a moment, Zach Stocks on the Zach Zone coming up. The Zach Zone with Zachary Scheidt. Zach is a portfolio manager at Stearman Capital and blogs at zachstocks.com.
Well, hey, Andrew. It's been an interesting week, and I think we're at a very critical spot in the overall market right now with the S&P moving right up to the 200-day average, and things are actually starting to look a little bit tired. I'm not calling the top here, but I do think that you have to have a more balanced approach. The fact that we've run up close to that 200-day moving average has not stopped the new issues market from trading very nicely. There was only one IPO this week, but there were five different secondary offerings that came to market. The IPO was Pioneer Southwest Energy. That's ticker symbol PSE, and it traded very nicely out of the gate. They priced it at $19. It traded above 20, almost to 21, and then backed off towards the end of the week to finish just below 20 bucks. These energy limited partnerships are not going to give you the same kind of pop as a Visa or something like that, but they should offer stable returns, and they usually have a great dividend yield. Out of the secondary offerings, the one that you need to take note of is MCSI, ticker symbol MXB. This is actually a spinoff from Morgan Stanley, and it's a financial information company. The stock was offered to investors at $29 on Tuesday, and by the end of the week, it traded all the way up to $31.74. So that's a really nice return, about a 10% return. I'm not really that particularly interested in the name long term, but you can take some education out of this one by seeing that they were able to bring a financial stock to market and get it priced, get it sold, and get it trading in a pretty healthy manner. So that's interesting just to think about the overall financial sector. Next week, there are going to be three IPOs on the calendar, and the one that you need to pay attention to is Colfax Corp. That's ticker symbol CFX, and this company manufactures fluid handling products. These guys sell to big oil companies as well as the marine industry, and so they're definitely in a hot area right now. So watch for this one to trade up sharply, and if you can get some stock on the deal, I would definitely encourage you to ask for it. So looking at what I'm trading right now, my current portfolio is fairly balanced. I don't. We talked about the rain coming, and I don't feel any raindrops yet, but I see more and more clouds on the horizon. So I'm trying to even things up a little bit. Some of the names that I'm trading from the long side have broken out and then kind of backed off. They appear a little tired later in the week. So a couple examples of this are eHouse China, that's ticker symbol EJ, and then GFA, which is a Brazilian housing company. Both of these names have shown great breakouts, but then they've kind of backed off, and I've gone ahead and taken profits on a portion of my position, and I'm going to be holding the rest for longer term gains, and if they don't shape up here pretty soon, then I'll probably have to sell the other half, but I'm going to give them a shot anyway. The other names that I'm trading, let's see, there are a couple that are ramping much higher that I'm just kind of sitting back and watching because they're not looking tired at all. Blackstone, ticker symbol BX, and China Finance Online, that's ticker symbol JRJC. These are two different examples of stocks that have made decent bases, and they're trading higher, they're looking healthy, and so what I do is, in this kind of situation, I just trail my stops. I say that as long as they're trading in this trend, I'm going to hold on to them, and if they start backing off, then I start selling little bits and pieces here and there. So that's the long side, and I'm getting some opportunistic shorts on as well to kind of hedge out my overall position and balance myself so that a higher market won't hurt me and a lower market won't hurt me. And one of the names that I'm looking at, and I've already taken a short position in, is Baidu, ticker symbol BIDU. I hope that's how you pronounce it. I'm not Chinese, but these guys are the Chinese equivalent of a Google, and they're operating profitably. They've got some great new products. They've got good revenue. They reported earnings late in April, and everything looked good. So I know that sounds like a great bull case, but there's some subtle cracks that are developing as you look closer at the numbers. Their traffic acquisition cost, what it costs them to get new traffic and new people actually looking at their site, are moving higher because they're paying people to direct the traffic to them. This is squeezing their margins, and it's going to make profitability a little more difficult. They're going to continue to be profitable, but it's going to back off to some degree. There are also competitors out there, and while Baidu is obviously the leader in this area, it'll be interesting to see if Google and or partnership that Yahoo's involved in can begin to steal some market share away. The stock is trading at a very high multiple. It's running into a resistance area after a tumultuous turn lower at the beginning of the year. It's traded back up tentatively, and it's running into a, an area that I think is going to prove pretty good resistance. So I am short the name right now. If you short this name, you should do it with a tight stop, and you should use discipline so that you don't get caught holding something short that's just ramping higher. But I think that there's a good shot that it'll move lower, and I'm happy to hold it short in conjunction with my other longs so that I'm holding a pretty balanced portfolio. So anyway, for more information about these stocks and other new issues, please give me a visit at zachstocks.com. That's Z-A-C-H stocks.com. And I can't wait to see you guys next week.
All right. Hey, thanks so much, Zach. That is a I'm going to be shorting Baidu. That is playing with a little bit of fire there. Chinese stock market has been just absolutely all over the place. Well, that's going to wrap it up for The Disciplined Investor, episode number 55. We have lots in store next week. We're going to get back into some of the basics. I'm going to tell you about some things about the workbook. And do me a favor, as I mentioned before, do me a favor. Please go and fill out that survey online at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Pick up a book. I promise it's going to help you be profitable. And if you need any help otherwise, of course, do me a favor, drop me a line. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com is the best way to get me. Hopefully, we are going to have another decent week, but I will tell you that keep your eyes on the markets. Keep your eyes on the announcements. Read between the lines. That's what you need to be doing right now. Andrew Horowitz, episode 55. We're signing off. Thanks a lot for joining me. Hasta luego. Hasta la vista. Happy Cinco de Mayo. We'll see you soon. Adios.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.